version scientist. I'm Brian Massey, and today I'm on the hot seat at the Austin Content Marketing Meetup.
Brian Massey is the conversion scientist. He writes for his own blog, the conversionscientist.com. He also writes for the Content Marketing Institute, for Search Engine Land, and for
Clixie.
And the fact that we actually have somebody here who writes for the Content Marketing Institute, to me, is huge. And I think one of the interesting things about Brian is that he's really the one that I see has so clearly married the marketing with the content. You know, basically using content to convert. But I have my very first question is a very important question when it comes to content marketing. What's up with the lab coat?
I'm glad you asked, because I come bearing presents. So the lab coat is very important because it reminds us that we are not just throwing shit against the wall. It reminds us that we're also checking to see what's stuck.
Wow.
The lab coat tells us that we are using science,
I'm not worthy.
Data, the scientific method, and that we can stop guessing or stop relying on pure hit or miss creativity. Marketing is about understanding who's coming to your site and giving them what they want. And that's what the lab coat tells us and ensures that we remember. So I will try to remember that throughout this conversation. It's easy to stump me because I don't know everything. And everybody's audience is going to be a little bit different. So. That is the lab coat. You look good, man.
Oh, thank you.
I gotta get a picture.
I
gotta get a picture. Anybody, sorry. Anybody who is advancing the education on conversion is changing the world fundamentally. I mean, why buy more traffic when we can just convert more of what we got?
Okay, so I have a question for you. So, you mentioned a lot of your writing about these conversion beacons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a lot of people here are bloggers. A lot of people here blog for personal reasons.
How many of y'all are bloggers? Holy Moses. Definitely into the content. How many of you guys sell something online? All right. A few of you. How many of you generate leads online? All right. Good. So everybody's got some sort of conversion end goal. Almost everybody. Readers and visitors is one thing. But I need a new lead. I want to sell a product. Those are the things that move our businesses forward. So go on with your question.
Oh yeah, so a lot of us blog and you know, we're into the creative and the content part of it. But what is a conversion beacon? I mean, why have a conversion beacon, and what is it, and how is the best way to do it?
Okay, so conversion beacon can be anything from an ad, a call to action. It can be a link in your content, beside your content, around your content. The idea is this with content, right? So first of all, we want to do great content because it gets the search engine's eyes. Conversion is it's a fraction, it's a ratio. And on top, we put the number of people who take action, who do something to move our business forward. On the bottom is the number of people who come at all. So it is the number of people who convert to being a customer or a lead over the number of visitors that we get to our site. So you can increase your conversion rate by changing either one of those. Great content increases the number of people that are coming to your site. Targeted content brings quality traffic. So I can put out something on Stumble and just rocket the number of people who visit my site. My conversion rate goes to the toilet because they're not qualified. They're not really interested in what I'm doing. But as I put out articles on Content Marketing Institute, the people that are reading those, because I talk about what I do, are relevant. So when they come looking for me, that traffic is relevant. So I have less traffic than a lot of sites, but I think I do a pretty good job of getting targeted traffic thanks to the content that I'm putting out. So that's the first thing. And of course, the second thing is, what better brand experience, what better site experience than answering somebody's question, teaching them something? This is the power of content. This is where you can really start to crank up your conversion rates. So you're bringing more quality traffic with great content, and the content is helping them solve a problem. Even if it's very self-serving, if you're helping them choose your company and its products, that's what they're looking for. So the mistake that we make is broadcast TV they couldn't target people. They had to broadcast to everybody. Brochures are print marketing devices when you don't know who you're talking to. You could be talking to anybody. So they have to be very broad. They have to be catchy. They have to be humorous. They have to be all these things that we have all assigned to marketing now. Online, we don't have to do that. If we run an ad and we get a click to the page, we know they came from the ad. We know what we promised them, right? We can produce content that's targeted to solve that problem, to live up to that promise in the ad. So we don't have to be as clever, but we do have to be smarter. And we have to know that people on the web, as opposed to people that are watching TV, are sitting there thinking, I've got to solve this problem, and I've chosen now to do it. So if you're in front of them, help them do that. Help them make a good decision, even if you're helping them make a competitor's decision. Somebody was talking to me last night, was they're a startup, and they're like, oh my gosh, in our presentations, they're giving away all the metrics that we're tracking and all this stuff. I'm like, give it away. Let people know. Help people make decisions, because the problem is not going to be that people are going to steal your ideas. The problem is not enough people are going to know about you, what you're promising. Or they're going to see what you do, and they're not going to know how to make a good decision. I say give it away. Give it away.
Yeah, somebody, I heard the other day, somebody said that even if you give away, like, proprietary information, or the information that's your secret sauce, one thing is learning about it, the other thing is actually executing.
Right. Well, and to answer your question about conversion beacons, all conversion beacon is a way for you online to wave your hands and say, here is an answer to your question, or here's one step in the answer to your question. Here's the first piece of information I want to give you. So, however you need to do that, if you want to put, you can put conversion beacons inside videos, and in fact, if you're using video, which is a fantastic traffic generator, and certain segment of your readership is going to love video, it's just doing gangbusters, put it in the video. It says, I hope, you know, thanks for watching. Did you know that if you click over here, or if you click on this button, or if you complete this form, you get something else? And I'm going to continue to educate you. Conversion is actually a scenario rather than a point. We think a conversion happens on a landing page. But it really happens when they get the white paper that tells them about the webinar, that tells them about the newsletter, then they get the email that tells them about the services and how they get the free consultation, and then the sales guy takes over and closes it for the business. That's really what conversion is. And each of those steps is what we call micro-conversion. So you can measure individual steps, find out where people are dropping off, but answering their questions all the way through to purchase, that's really conversion. Can y'all hear all right back there, or do we need to shout more?
You can hear the guy over here, but he's leaving. He's shout more.
He's leaving.
Go insult him a little bit. I'm going to knock that over. So does that answer your question? Conversion beacon?
Yeah.
Click here is a conversion beacon. Add to cart is a conversion beacon. Download is a conversion beacon. Watch the video is a conversion beacon. Anything that starts somebody on one of your conversion scenarios. And I like the term beacon because it implies that you're using words and that you're using design and white space and all the things designers do that I don't understand. But I know when I see it, when it works, to get their attention and say, hello, here's where your answers start.
Okay, I got another question. Please feel free, everybody. This is very interactive, so ask away whenever you have something to ask. But I have another. Go ahead.
Is there a hashtag for this?
Yeah, Austin Content.
I have a nuts and bolts question.
Okay.
Do you use WordPress?
I do use WordPress.
There are another points at your site where you encourage people to like get a free ebook or get this free white paper or just give me your address. Is there a plugin you use for that, or is that all custom done?
It really depends. So if I say the word pop-up, I know a lot of you guys will groan. I've never seen a test where a pop-up did not significantly increase conversion rates. So everybody I talk to says, I hate pop-ups. Well, somebody's lying to me. Because the pop-ups are working. Right. So for pop-ups, there is a plugin that I use. I have not started testing pop-ups on my site yet.
Which plugin are you using?
It's called, is it Pop-Up Domination? Pop-up Domination.
That's a paid one.
It is. I actually paid for that. But you know why I chose that is because the entrepreneur that put that together used it on his site. And so while we don't necessarily want to have the same brand experience of the affiliate marketers, they test the hell out of their pages. So when I see someone that's selling a plugin, I know that the templates they're putting together may be a great starting point for me to have maximized my conversions, as opposed to an engineer who just figured out how to do an Ajax box.
Plus, when you get paid plugins or themes or anything else for that matter, you get more likely to get support and the more likely to keep up with it.
You would hope so. You would hope so.
I mean, your odds are better.
Yes, I would agree. Pop-up domination. It was $50, I think, so it wasn't expensive. But they have a number of side-by-side, top and bottom. And the thing is, so I study the affiliate market, and I've seen it in a number of other places. So if these guys keep using it.
And then you raise the downloads, like yes, someone downloads it, and then they sign up.
What you would want to do is drop your own form in there. And it does have an integration, I think, with like MailChimp or something like that. But you can put your own form in there. Okay.
So what's the low hanging fruit? I've got a small business, small budget client who says, "All right, I'm convinced. I'm ready to go down this path."
Oh.
What's the shortest chain that works if you're just kind of getting rolling in this idea of being a conversion?
So I would say, in terms of content,
just the shortest chain that works. You know, the content, is it a pop-up and an ebook, or you know, do you have a combination that works well?
So I think that it depends on who you are, but I'll tell you kind of the. So I love this idea of what I call a content cascade. And all of us kind of have a preference or a tendency to produce content in a certain way. So when I put it on, I have a voice for radio. So podcasting was something that I always enjoyed doing. As you can tell, I like to talk. So that's my starting point. That might be a great chance for me to start by recording a podcast. Take that, drop that off on Elance or Fiverr, get a transcript done. That becomes something I can hand to a copywriter. Copywriter takes it, formats it, pulls out headlines, cleans it up, spell checks it. That becomes a white paper. I take each of those sections, turn it into a blog post, expand on it a little bit. So I've got my blog posts. Each one of those blog posts is going to get between 3 and 5 tweets. And if each one's written individually, 3 and 5 posts on Facebook, so you got 140 character version of that. So you've got this entire cascade from this one action of recording a podcast, right? When you've done enough of those, you can pull them together, drop them into an ebook, and then put lead generation in front of that.
Or sell it.
Sell it or put lead generation. The ebooks seem to be doing very, very well. I've got 3 half done, so I can't say what's working for me yet. But I'm more of a speaking audio sort of guy, and I struggle on long form content. I love short form though.
So all the stuff you're going to put in an ebook is all content you've already done. You're not doing new content for anything.
Yeah. So for instance, like an ebook that's my first year's columns on Clixi for display advertising or behavioral marketing. I've got Search Engine Land won't let me do that with theirs because they've got a different ownership model. But I could do that probably with Content Marketing Institute now. It's pulled together a content and conversion ebook. Let me write that down. I think that's another. How many of you guys are small or solo entrepreneurs? Yeah. So it's amazing the ideas. If you can get in a room like this or have conversations like this, because this may just be me, but speaking through these problems really helps you galvanize what you should do next. Like that awareness was just, it should be so obvious, but it's not.
I've always got stuck on thinking that if I do an ebook, it has to be new content, or a newsletter, it has to be new content. I can't duplicate content in a blog because it'll just piss people off.
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you this, that if you were smart, you would have just a little something and test the titles until you figure out what the titles are. So do 5 pages, right? Do 5 pages. That's, you know, with layout, that's 2 blog posts or 3 blog posts, right? Offer it, you have to charge something, so either ask for lead information or charge $1.99 or whatever. Just so that there's a cost, and see, you know, if people convert on that sort of thing. And then when you find those things that they really like, that's when you go in and you say, I'm going to fill this out, I'm going to pay to have it edited and laid out and all that stuff. Blog posts. I actually redesigned my blog about a year ago because I had the traditional 5 posts on the homepage. So So my bounce rates were 70% because people were coming and getting everything they needed from the homepage and going about their business, right? So I changed it where I only put teasers on the homepage. And what that allows me to do is see which articles get clicked on the most so that I can tell what I should be writing more about. So little things like that. And then you go and you spend every week, you're going to spend a few minutes with your analytics and see what you learn about the crowd. I am not a analyst. In other words, I don't spend a lot of time in the database extracting insights from the numbers and doing regressions and correlations. I go in and, you know, I kind of use the, I see analytics more as a seismograph. So you're measuring vibrations, and if I take a piece of content and drop it into social media, if I take a piece of content, drop it onto my blog, drop it into email, which by the way makes the biggest waves, I can measure the waves through the little graphs on I love Google Analytics. Woopra is great. Clicky. Woopra, W-O-O-P-R-A. Woopra gives you real time, and they have a great desktop application. Clicky is, I think, considered the easiest. So if you're new to analytics, getclicky.com would be a great place to start. And you watch and you see, if you see a spike, you know something happened there, and you go back and you find out what piece of content was that, or who tweeted that, or what have you.
Do you recommend a paid service like Sprout Social to measure your impact?
So I haven't used Sprout Social, and is, if I'm familiar with the class, I might be getting mixed up with Scout.
I've not heard of Scout. They have a 30-day free trial I just finished. I blogged about it. It's $9 a month. And they show you when someone retweets you, how many more people you reached and so on and so forth, which
right.
You can see manually. But they put it all together, did multiple tweet accounts and so on.
So I use a service called Spreadfast. Now they're an Austin company, Spreadfast, and I love it. It's my social media dashboard, and it integrates with all the things I use. It integrates with Google Analytics, it integrates with Flickr, Facebook, Twitter. What am I leaving out? LinkedIn is in there, and it's tracking everything from the number of friends that I've got to the traffic that I'm getting. Oh, it integrates with Bitly, and I can use that shortener. So the social media conversion strategy that I use is what I call a content-oriented strategy. So there's two components, I think, to social media conversion. And actually, the first is true of a landing page, a website, and it's trust, right? Now, in social media, you don't have the multimedia that you do on the page. You can't put a VeriSign logo out in social media. It's your conversations and what you talk about and how you treat other people that build trust. The second one is conversion beacons. How you get conversion beacons out into social media. Well, URL shorteners are awesome because I can take a heavily instrumented link back to a piece of content on my site, shrink it up, and share that on social media, and that becomes something I can measure. So the part that's hard to measure is how you're building trust as you're having conversations, growing your social graph. So we'll let that go for now, because I don't know if Sprout and Scout and I get a sense of it from Spreadfast, Techrigy, Radian 6 is probably the market leader right now in terms of that sort of thing. Buzzstream is another Austin company that does a PR-focused social CRM. So there's lots of ways for me to go and see what's going on out there from a number standpoint. But when I launch a piece of content with a link and I drive people back to my site, I can measure that action, and that's more important to me than a like if my website is ready to catch them and convert them. So they come to the site, they read the article. I can put conversion beacons in the article if I want to. Download this spreadsheet, download. And I do have little PDFs and things that I put into my articles. I can put ads out on the side. That's where I usually put my, you want to get the conversion scientist, my email, sign up here. So you're putting conversion beacons around that so they take the next step. And that takes them to another thing, and you surround that with conversion beacons. So you're educating, but you're never losing sight of the fact that you're bringing people to your site because you're running a business, or you're trying to change the world, or whatever your thing is. You're an artist and you just want more people to see what you have to say. You know, I'm agnostic in terms of what you want to accomplish.
Brian, I got a question for you. Okay. You published some research that you did on converting people from social media to your in-house email list, your customer database. And you've also mentioned in other places that the email is the world's largest social network.
My grandmother friended me on email. She hasn't friended me on Facebook yet.
So, I mean, so tell me a little bit. You know, in the last 2 years, social media has generated such buzz, and you know, the media is so focused on it as the new way to generate business. But what you're showing is sort of something that sort of reinforces the basics of e-commerce or of online business, which is that it's the list, right? Tell us a little bit more about some of these findings that you had that were kind of surprising for me actually and for other people.
So my favorite analogy around this is, you're spending money and time. And entrepreneurs, most of us are small businesses, time is more valuable than money, right? Time is what we really lack, even though we spend a lot of time on the money, or focusing on the money, it's the time that's the issue. So you're spending that, building your trust, writing your articles, sharing them on social media, sharing them in email, wherever you can share them. So there's a real cost to each of those visitors. So you've got a couple of options in terms of taking that energy. If you see the traffic as electricity, how do I attach a battery to that and charge, and keep the charge from that? The person comes and they leave, and that's their interface with my content. How do I save that in a battery? And there's really now two excellent ways to do that. My favorite is email. Number one, because it requires a bit more qualified and committed person to do that. It also requires you to do a better job of building the value of your email list. So you have to have a stronger conversion beacon. Or have them join you on social media, which is and I treat social media very much as a list, because I focus more on the conversion-oriented side of things than on the trust-building side of things, probably to my detriment. So I think that if I did an experiment, said I'm going to spend 30 days having conversations on the internet, and compare that to the previous 30 days where all I did was share my stuff, I think I would see an increase in conversion rates. I have not done that test yet. But the point that I'm trying to make, and that you can treat a good social graph that way. Thank them for the retweets, but you can really pretty much use them as a broadcast method, very much like email seems to be. To great effect. It's measurable. The clicks are measurable, as I said. We're instrumenting the click-throughs. We can measure the traffic coming from each of the social networks. We know what's going on. So I calculated last summer that I had a social conversion rate of about 2.5%. But my conversion rate on my email was closer to 20% in terms of people joining my list. So, So in that one, I was converting the social media to an email subscriber, and I was counting the people on my general list, my personal list, to convert to get my blog posts. So it was both of those were conversion to join my conversion sciences list.
So that's a conversion for you.
That is a conversion for me. That's right.
Establishing a communication channel.
That's right, because right now my business is done. I close my business on the phone, like more of a consultant, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't have products that I sell yet.
Brian, I'm curious, what do you see as the number one purpose of the emails that you send out? Now, I say that as a copywriter, my specialty is email.
That is a great question, and it's to persuade them to read something I think that they should read, or to come to something like this. Primarily when I'm sending an email out, I'm trying to get another opportunity to educate, because that builds my brand and it gives it. Conversion has been the most important thing in marketing forever, but it seems like a new term and people aren't thinking about it, because getting people's attention always seemed like the big problem. So I have a lot of educating to do. So most of my emails are targeted at getting people to conversion beacons that say learn more about it here, learn here. I'm talking about email here, I'm talking about buttons here, I'm talking about copy here, whatever, you know, that has a lot of moving parts, so that's my primary.
I can speak to the value of Brian's list. I was on it, and he sent out a list of all of the headlines from South by Southwest, like
how smart people were at naming their
words. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was so clever. That really brought me a lot of value. I didn't try to sell or anything. Not like you shouldn't, but like, it's, you should sign up for his email.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, I that one did very well. Obviously, South by Southwest is a great keyword to put into a blog post and an email, and I got a number of subscribers from that. So it did work, and it was all based on somebody else's creativity. It was they named their, but that's content. I mean, the people are looking for education. They're looking for curation. They want to know what you think is important, and I've really started doing that. I'm not going to dive off though. I want to make sure I answer you guys' questions. But you don't have to write pure content. Back to my point is, if your starting point is video, if your starting point is podcasting, if you're a news junkie, pull a bunch of news together and make that what you're writing about. Because each of those can be a blog post and tweets and all the things. They will all cascade. Other questions?
If I wanted to, I know it's easy to curate someone else's blog post on Twitter. I can say, hey, this is a great article. Here's a link. If I wanted to do something like that on my blog, if I read something of yours that was so great and I wanted to comment on it, what do you prefer? What's the kindest, most polite way to curate someone else's material? I mean, I think I know the answer, but I want to hear your perspective on how to share longer form content curation.
On the form. What do you mean? What's the distinction
like,
there?
I read a great post that you wrote.
Okay.
And I want to share it with my audience. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a tweet does it justice. So I'm going to write a little review of your material and link to it. What could I do to make that even more beneficial for you? Because I think that's obviously part of my goal is building a relationship with the original author of the material. So do you want links? What's the right way to...
So that is a huge social gesture. Now, I think a lot of the bigger bloggers have a lot of that, so they're a little bit more like, yeah, thanks, man, whatever. But I mean, whenever somebody does that for me, it's huge. So,
what do you like to see when someone does that? Kind words and a big link.
Actually, less the kind words. You know what I love to see is somebody who's good at summarizing it. Somebody can take my rambling and get it down to 4 points. My first reaction is, making me look bad by summarizing my own stuff, but, and you're like, wow, that's a great way to put it. I've been doing personas for a while, and I use the Eisenberg Brothers strategy, and we had this one concept is the mode of persuasion, and it's about how people like to get information, and where you put it on the page, and things like that. And I was like, mode of persuasion, every time I say that, people kind of go, And it was somebody else who was taking those and summarizing them and said, this is really a research mode. And I'm like, yes, people are coming to websites to solve problems. It's their mode of research or their research mode. Completely transformed that whole portion of the persona. So I love good summaries. There are probably a lot of people that like the, oh, he's so smart sort of thing. I'm like,
I rather curate a lot of your own content, like the ones that you have on the Content Marketing Institute and Search Engine Land. You curate that on your own website, right?
Oh, I do. But what I'm trying to do there is, since I don't have access to the analytics on Search Engine Land and Content Marketing Institute and ClickZ, I have to create my own social landing page. So I write a blog post that summarizes maybe one point in there. Already I've proven that I can't summarize my own stuff. So that when I send the series of tweets and Facebook posts out, it's coming to my site first, and then I point them on to the full article. And so that lets me be a little racier with my content, a little more interesting, a little more controversial, maybe than the publishers prefer, although I don't get much pushback at all. But most importantly, my Google Analytics is getting ticked, so I know which of those topics is working. Plus, I'm giving them some nice keyword juice over there. I want some of that for myself, too, so I reuse the keywords and stuff like that. So that's a great strategy. I mean, everything should go through your blog post. Anybody who subscribed to my email list automatically gets an email once a week if I have new stuff on my blog. So making sure that all that goes to my blog ensures that everybody on my lists are also getting that information and can follow through. I'm big on automating. I am. I'm. I like Feedblitz.
What's the question?
RSS to emails. Okay. About
right. So what it does is, it once a week, And you can program it. It can be once an hour if you want. It checks my feed, and if it sees a new post, it drops it into a template that I designed, which includes some conversion beacons, like for free consultation, so that people will take the next step. If I had a book out or a PDF that I wanted to market, I would put those in that. Drops the content in there and automatically sends it off to my list. Manages my opt-outs for me. You always want to give people a chance to opt out.
That's not the one that's part of FeedBurner? Is it a different one?
FeedBurner will do that, but you can't set up your own template. All FeedBurner will do is ship off the information. So you don't get a chance, unless you include the conversion beacons in your copy, you don't get a chance to feed Blitz. That's a terrible interface. It's hard to use, but when you get there, it's probably the most flexible tagging and template.
MailChimp,
AWeber and MailChimp both do. The nice thing about MailChimp is they let you import your existing lists. AWeber does not, but AWeber's delivery rates are probably the best in the industry as a result.
What do you mean by that?
So when you're sending email, the first challenge you have is getting it to the person. And there's a company here in town called MX Toolbox. If you want to go type in your domain, your email domain to mxtoolbox.com. They're also a client. And see if you're on any blacklist. They actually will give you a green light, red light for a list of blacklists this long. ISPs are making sure that spam doesn't get through. Well, unfortunately, a lot of those are going to catch you for whatever reason. So what the ESPs do, the email service providers do, is they negotiate. If you get on a spam list, they work to get you off. They work to keep their IPs clean, make sure that they're not being tagged as spammers, and you get to ride on those coattails. So since AWeber says we won't let you import anything, it prevents anybody from sneaking any sort of spam packs, you know, lists that don't have permission. Every name that's in AWeber has had to go through a sign up. And most of them gone through double opt-in, which is that it means they get a confirmation email, and they're not on the list until they actually click on that. So it's very clean. It's hard for spammers to get on there. And so the ISPs really trust them. And they send AWeber traffic through all day and night, whereas other email service providers will get bogged up. And so that's what we call deliverability. Does that answer your question? As I said, traffic is the bottom thing. You got to get it to them before you can start counting conversions.
Can we circle back around to curation?
Yeah.
So, kind of old school about curation.
Okay.
It's about selection and preservation, archiving, presentation.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of stuff in curation, but when I talk to people about curation, they seem to think it's about a summary and a link and off you go. And people have a curation light sort of attitude towards curation.
You know,
I'm not really sure what this is. It's not curation, though. But 99% of what I see that's labeled curation isn't.
Regurgitation, then?
Aggregation, even?
Aggregation?
Bibliographic aggregation?
Maybe so. You know, the term curation means to me a little bit more over time. In other words, you're creating a collection over time as opposed to gathering a bunch of stuff together and packaging, repackaging it. Right.
When you go to a museum, the curator has selected 10 of the best Rembrandts, not all 1,500.
Right.
And said, here's a theme of Rembrandts.
Right.
And we've curated this, and we provide all this other information about Rembrandt.
Right.
And we add value.
The museum curator is applying his filter, so he likes blue, so he's collected all of the blue Rembrandts. You know that blue is the primary. So fine. Everybody who's really likes blue Rembrandts or blue paintings is going to find that museum, that gallery,
right,
interesting. Rembrandt would never think to package his stuff in just blue.
So how does that fit in? How does curation help us with language? Sorry, my knee's going to be you're seeking out better conversion.
So I think the kind of the purest version of curation that you're talking about, quite honestly, requires more of a commitment. So curation like you're talking about, I think of like infographs. They are really helpful, really popular. Does anybody not know what I mean when I talk about an infograph? These long form collections of stats.
Define what it is, because see it and I, but what does it mean?
They're typically a collection of statistics on a topic with some sort of visual representation so that you, you know, and I've seen them that go on and on and on. So I would call that kind of your kind of curation and what you're saying, I'm going to collect from reliable sources, I'm going to present in a way that adds value to the data, and the fact of the juxtaposition that I brought these things together is going to create a completely different experience around the data. As opposed to what I would call more of a passionate curation, where you read something, you're like, oh my God, this guy put it so beautifully, and you just want to share that, right? So I use a bookmarking service called Digo, D-I-I-G-O, and every time I want to share something, I click it in my browser and it goes off. And I only share things that require something like, oh, this is, I couldn't have put this better, or if you don't realize, if I have a little something to add, but it's usually not more than a sentence because it's going to be going out on Twitter and Facebook. I grab that RSS feed and aggregate a couple of my lists through Yahoo Pipes, and then that goes out to, I think Ping FM is how I distribute that. I use one of those services, RSS, Twitter, I don't know. I've put them all together and I've forgotten how they work, but I know that when I add something to a certain list on Digo that I'm going to get an email and I'm going to get, it's going to go out on social media. So that's kind of, and that list, I don't think I get a lot of visits to that list, but that would be like my gallery. You know, one of the things is we have topical issues, you know, so the things that I tweeted last year may not even be relevant anymore. You know, anything I've tweeted or I've put on there about Friendster, not really very helpful, right? So, I don't know if there's a, you know, formal curation, there's a requirement that you, you know, you prune it occasionally as well, right? That, you know, a piece of curated content has a lifespan.
Do you do any
information,
Tom?
Well, one of the things that I try to get people to do, clients to do, is they're really good at spitting things up on the wall when it comes to content, but they never ever create a roadmap, a keystone content. So like when I arrive at your company X and I'm visiting your Y vertical product solutions, give me a friggin' roadmap for what all those things that are dangling down underneath, all those blog posts and applications and patches and white papers and case studies that all belong in this vertical. Like, help me, you know, self-curate, you know, give me a roadmap of, you know, when I first arrived as the first cold-caller user with no understanding of what your business is, how do I navigate all that stuff that's out there so that I can actually make a freaking buying decision by picking up the phone or filling out a form, right?
Yeah, and so we try to automate some of that stuff through the archives with the months and then the topic tags and stuff. And it doesn't accomplish what you're talking about.
No, and it takes an actual human to write up a summary of what's happening in the business.
If I sat down and said, all right, if I was new to this site, and there are a lot of new, I get a lot of new traffic, what's the first thing I think this person should know about?
Right.
I haven't done that. So I get your point. And that's powerful. So, I mean, we're talking about, you know, I have personas for my site, but I haven't really done that. All right, the first thing they need to see is this. And,
there's a plugin called, I think it's called What Would Seth Godin Do?
Yes, I have that on my site.
Which is kind of like that. So it's for someone who's never been to your site, they see a special message where you get to say.
That's right. So you can say, new visitors, pop this up on the third visit or the fifth visit, so you can control.
Right.
WWSGD is what it's called. What would Seth Godin do?
What's Seth Godin do, yeah. Well, I'm talking more like what we used to do for IBM was we used to write these 1,500 word articles that would just summarize the entire zone and say, if you're brand new to XML development, slam one, slam two, slam three, list, link, go get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, start here and here. Right?
And have you tested anything like that on your blog? Or?
I haven't yet, because I don't have a lot of stuff that needs to be self-curated, but we do that for, I mean, there are companies out there that generate a shit ton of content.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you see the weekly summary, like Outspoken Media does a good job every week of saying these are our favorite posts.
Right.
But they're doing three or four a day. You know,
so I'm wondering if you look at that and say, is this a waste of time?
I've never tested that specific kind
of conversion, like, benefit to doing all that work.
But I'll tell you what, there's a mode of research called The Competitive, and they are looking for that. So they want to know what the boundaries are. All right, they want to know what the pieces of the model are. And then when they say, this makes sense to me, they will drill down on each of those. So the kind of content you're talking about appeals to a specific mode of research, and they make decisions very quickly, very logically. And they're going to be looking for that thing. So that's why, you know, I think that's why 12 ways, 5 ways, 6 tips, why those time and time again are always the most clicked on articles. It's because I'm going to get the high level view, and then if I want to, hopefully the author's going to give me some drill downs on those.
When you use those numbers, you usually use the numerals, or do you spell out the numbers? What's the best way?
No, the numbers. That's better. Rather than, although spelling them out is grammatically correct.
No, it's what works best that's the best.
Well, that's not always true. I mean, we do have brands, right? So I don't have any sales letter pages. It doesn't really fit my brand. Of course, you know, if I did it and saw how well it worked, I'd say, screw the brand. But no, that's not true. That's not true. So if, you know, if grammar is important to your brand, then spell them out. You won't get as many clicks, but, you know, there's a balance you want.
But you get a higher qualified set of clicks.
But you might get, that's right, if you're selling grammar tools, you can't do that, right? You want people who care about grammar, and then, oh my God, they started a sentence with a number!
PhD clicks.
But that's why the personas are so helpful, because you start to understand those things, and you can start making decisions like that as you put together your content calendar. Which, I mean, even having a roadmap for what you're going to talk about is the challenge, let alone telling your audience what the hell you're talking about. So.
Okay, so your expertise is in testing content and conversion. What about for all of us who mostly have other types of work to do during the day? What are some best practices for us to be able to test our stuff to increase conversion, and how do we go about doing this?
So I would do this. We are all conversion scientists to some extent, all right? How many of you have analytics on your blog or on your website? So most of you do. How many of you have you looked at it in the last 30 days? All right, so you're actually looking at it. So you're actually looking at what's going on. There are a couple of disciplines that if you put these in place, you will be doing formal conversion scientist lab coat tests, right? The first thing is you're going to make a change, which can be anything from changing a component on your site, like if you want to change a form, maybe you're going to move from FeedBurner to FeedBlitz, so your form is going to change on how you gather emails. You can change the color of a button, or you're going to do a blog post, or you're going to add a page and change your navigation. Something like that. Every time you make a change, stop and say, if I was to come up with one hypothesis for this, what would it be? If I was going to say, in making this change, I expect X to happen. So most of the time it's going to be, if I write a blog post on content marketing meetup, if I do a follow-up to this and do a blog post, I would expect to have a significant increase in Austin traffic, and I would expect to have a significant increase in return traffic. People who already know who I am, because a lot of you guys already know who I am, right? So that was just a hypothesis. And all I need to do is jot that down, do my blog post, and say, how am I going to measure this? Right. So think about it. Austin visitors, how do I measure Austin visitors, really? Well, it turns out that if you use the right analytics package, it becomes pretty easy. You can say, all right, well, we may have to limit it just to Texas, because that's all I can measure. Anyways, so you have to stop and think how you're going to measure that. You make your change, you wait the appropriate amount of time, and you go and look and see how you did. So you write the blog post, you put it up, you find out that it had a huge spike in traffic, but not much of it was coming from Texas. All right, well, you were wrong. You learned something. That when I write about live presentations, it really doesn't matter where the person is from. That seems to ring a bell or have an effect on my audience. In other words, I might infer from that that they're interested in more information on when I'm presenting. So I can do that, right? Maybe even go back and summarize some of the things they did last month, the month before. So being wrong, being right, there is no right and wrong. There's only what you learn. And if you put that hypothesis in front, say, how am I going to measure this? And then wait the right amount of time and go look, you learn something. And that's the scientific method, hypothesis. How are we going to measure it, test it? What are my conclusions? And you don't have to, you don't have to set up split testing and Google website optimizers and visual website, whatever you're going to use. It's called a serial test. So you're not controlling for time, so a lot of your stuff is invalid. You put something, you don't have it up, you do put something up, but one of your competitors does something different, and that changes the whole dynamic. Well, it's good if you could know that. So you're not controlling for time as you would with a split test, but still you're learning something as you go. And everyone begs a question. I promise you, you will not have do this one time without going, I wonder if it's because, now how would I test that? And it becomes your next hypothesis. Maybe I'm going to write a blog post specifically to test if people like my live stuff.
A minimum amount of traffic that you want to see before you start making decisions, or is a trend line enough for you?
Good question. So in terms of how long you want to test, minimum of a week, just because there's seasonality within the 7 days of the week, you get less, typically, you get less traffic on the weekends. Every business is different. Interestingly enough, I have a client that just gets much, much better results from email on the weekend than they do during the week. So everybody's a little bit different. For statistical validity, meaning the results, I can count on these results, 100 conversions is a rule of thumb that I use. So 100 leads, 100 purchases, whatever you're trying to test. And generally it requires thousands of visitors. So if you don't get to 100, but you can get 1,000 impressions, 1,000 unique visitors, then you can start to say, okay, I think we've achieved that. Does that answer your question? Those are just the rules of thumb. If it's 25 or more, you can probably learn something from it. Just don't take it to the bank. Don't fire everybody and invest in that one thing. You know what I'm saying? That if you see that you had a significant increase over a smaller period, that just tells you, well, I need to do another one of these and test it. Or I need to find a venue where I can get more traffic and try it out.
There's
one
over there.
Do I?
He's trying to make sure there wasn't a question.
Okay. When you start optimizing, where do you start?
Well, that's a good question. For e-commerce sites, start with the shopping cart, because what a heartbreak to get somebody to add something to the cart, click checkout, and then do something where you're dropping the ball, where you're losing trust, where you're confusing them. Because they're really like, do I really want to do this? Is this a reputable vendor? So in the shopping cart, you always start there, right? And then you back up. So from the shopping cart, typically you're going to a product page. If you're selling a product, you're going to a lead generation form or a landing page if you're generating leads. And you start there. It becomes a little bit more complex there, but functionally, if you're asking for too much information in your forms, you'll decrease your conversion rates. If you're asking for things like a social security number, you will crater your conversion rates. But asking for an address when you don't need an address, asking for a phone number when you don't need a phone number, those will all decrease your conversion rates. If you ask for company size, company revenue, when they're going to buy, those will all decrease your conversion rates. But lower traffic, if you still have qualified visitors coming through, will increase your conversion. So it'll increase your qualified buy rates, right? So there, we have a lot of people coming, a lot of people saying no, but the people that are converting are better, and you'll have close ratios better with those guys. So the forms, your buttons, the general rule with the button is if it's a different color from everything else on the page, people are going to get that they can take action. And headlines, and subject lines. So I think we're all being taught how to be creative in 140 characters. I think subject lines and headlines are just going to get better and better and better. But those are, people tend to come in a competitive research mode. They're just looking for an excuse to stay on the page. If you can give them one, with a nice headline or an excuse to open the email, if you give them one with a nice subject line, then you'll get read, you'll be persuasive, and all of that will win. So that, I would start and work backward from there. That's a good question.
I'm curious, what do you think is more important to getting the email open, from the over subject line?
Which is more important? It depends on your audience. It depends on your audience. So if you're selling to a list that you've developed, I think the front line is most important. If you're selling to a list, if you're sending an email to somebody else's list in a joint venture, where they don't really know who you are, then subject line is going to be more important. It's the trust issue. If you're selling, you think about medical issues. I'm trying to think of a good example of a situation where it's where trust is really important, where I'm not just going to open and click through on any email. But health, those are usually very important. Relationships, motivational, things where people ask who before they'll ask what. The front line is going to be very important.
What are some easy to learn to use tools for tracking on what happens to email after you send it? I've recently been confronted for not sending a particular person's email, and the reason is it really goes into a spam folder, and I haven't been there.
Uh-huh.
But she's a personal friend. I'm just not interested in what she sends. Happens to choose to send it out.
Right. See, even in email, you have these social gestures now.
Yeah.
I mean, if I unfollow you, I get an email for everybody who drops off my list.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a social gesture, just like a social network.
That's right. I just kind of let it go into the spam folder. But how long do those trolls track on? And then do they also track on how long you spend on an open email before you close it?
Boy, I've never seen a client that would send that information back. So we don't really know how long people are spending. Generally, what we know is through an email service provider like iContact, Constant Contact. I like MailChimp. I love AWeber. Vertical Response is one that I use, but they don't have autoresponders. There's a whole science behind picking them. Emma has a nice presence here in Austin. I'm using them for one of my clients. So they're going to track your deliverability, as we talked about. How many people they think got the email. Open rates. Now, open rate is misleading because it doesn't actually measure how many people read it or opened it. It's just how many people turned on graphics, turned on images, because that's how they track it. Whenever their email client goes and grabs that image, somebody says, show me the images, that becomes an open.
So if you automatically have open images in your email, it just...
Previous, yes.
Just
automatically, that's right.
It's an open.
And if you send mostly text, in which people aren't incentivized to do that, your open rates look terrible. But it doesn't mean that they aren't reading it. So open rate, click-through rate, obviously. And then there's bounce rate, things that couldn't be delivered, and opt-out, people who click on opt-out to leave the list. Those are your primary measurements you're going to get from any email service provider. And the thing is, you want to measure, click-through rate is sometimes indicative, but you want to be able to measure through to conversion. So I use a technique called link tagging. And on my site, if you go to conversionscientist.com/resources, you can actually download a spreadsheet in which you enter a series of parameters, and it generates a URL for you that has all this stuff. And this will work if you use Google Analytics. Resources. ConversionScientist.com. And it is a conversion beacon. So you'll enter the date of the campaign, the date that was sent, how it was sent, what it was, and the URL. And it'll tag it all up so that when you open Google Analytics, you can actually say, all right, I only want to see the traffic that came from this email and what they did. And my e-commerce clients that use Google Analytics, they can tell how many sales were generated by each email link. By each email link, so you use a little bit different signature for each link of the email. So you find out if the image generated the most sale, or the text anchor. So we run that report, and in fact, it's accurate enough that I did a pay for performance project recently, and we use that to determine what my payout was. So actually, that was accurate. But the thing that it doesn't count is that email is a branding medium as well. There's a lot of people that will go and search afterwards, so they open it. Oh, got to remember that. Finish getting through their email, and go do a search. So not only do you see that, but you also will see an increase in search traffic and sales, which you can't directly measure.
I just want to say we have 4 minutes left, so get your questions in.
Okay. Did that answer the question? Whoever's. Did that answer your question? Sherry?
I have a question, and if this is really too rudimentary a question, tell me, and that's fine, we can go on to some
there answers. Are no rudimentary questions.
Okay. Well, that might very well be the case. So I'm a commercial photographer, and one of the things that I try to do is find information, obviously, related to photography, to tweet out and, you know, so mm-hmm. on and so forth, to share as content. And so I have some, what are they called, the Google alerts, thank you, on some phrases. But what I'm finding is, like, so for example, one of the things that I think people want to know is, how do I organize and keep track of the photos that I'm taking, okay? So I have an alert on photo archiving, that's my search term. Mm-hmm. But what I'm doing is I'm getting all these alerts on people selling slide pages and negative pages and stuff like that. That's obviously not
physical.
Right. Another one on, so what I'm more interested in is stuff like, how is imagery being used, say, for marketing and in advertising, those kinds of trends, things like that. And I'm not okay. having any luck finding that kind of content with the obvious search terms. So I guess I'm trying to find out, how do I find stuff that's maybe beyond the obvious in my particular area? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So stock photography is the great horrid crutch of designers, and it is a convert. It's like having a mannequin at your checkout stand at HEB.
Thank you. Just, oh, great one. Yes.
It's the worst thing you can put on your page. I would search. I do some search for eye tracking. Sometimes there's eye tracking around images. So they're talking about the marketing result. Like for instance, if you have somebody on your page looking at the visitor, they will focus on that and they won't read your conversion beacons. If you have them looking over at your conversion beacons, go to my site, see where I'm looking.
You and I talked about that.
And they're looking over at your conversion beacon or at a product. It casts the attention onto it. They've done eye tracking studies. It's amazing. So stock photography, if somebody smile, a pretty girl smiling, men and women will be drawn to that like crazy. And it they don't see the rest of the page as well. So little tricks like that are great.
Are you looking for search terms to find
honestly, more fundamentally is more. I'm not necessarily saying, hey, give me the search terms so I can write them down.
Yeah.
More, if the search terms I'm using aren't pulling up what I'm finding, like, what's my next step to try to figure out what those terms?
See, photographers have problems with words. I mean, converting the images to words.
I'm sorry.
Use exclude keywords.
Exclude keywords.
Yeah. Negative keywords.
For sale.
Okay.
Oh, I just have one last question.
Okay.
If you're starting out from scratch, you don't have an in-house email list, what's the quickest way to get some kind of amount of emails in your email list?
Export your Facebook posts.
Yeah.
And don't you have to get their permission to put them on your email list? Like, how do you do that? I mean, what's the best way to do
that?
Best marketing, your best list is going to be slow build, double opt-in, just be patient.
And give them something they want to read. I mean,
and have great content, that's right. Share it on social, and have a good conversion beacon for your list. So spend time, how you invite them to your list, how you say why they should join your list. And I would only ask for an email address. That will give you the easiest thing to do. If you want to personalize, ask for a first name only. That's the minimum.
Say please. Please join my email list. Please retweet. These are like huge words.
Really?
Right.
I heard that using the word because is good too. Mm-hmm. Join my list because.
Because is good.
There's a big study that can I cut in line in the copy machine in front of you? And
if the person said, can I cut in front of you because I'm late for something?
Yes.
94% of people would let you cut. If you went up and said, can I cut in front of you because today is Wednesday? Something like 92% would still let you cut. Like, you didn't even have to have a good reason.
Or you
didn't.
Just stop it because.
And then they tried that. Just stop it.
Can I cut in line because I got to make some copies? They even let her do that too.
Yeah. So you just saying the word because. And they did the study twice, 20 years apart, with the same results. So it's like human nature, just telling people that you.
The magic word was because.
Yes, that's probably right.
Yes. Because the reason why copy, do this because.
Yes. So please join my email list because.
You have a modicum of permission in LinkedIn lists, and you can export your Facebook lists by using Yahoo. Go to Yahoo Mail, set up an account. You can grab your Facebook, and so you can send them an invite. Say, well, I'd like you to be on my mailing list. But I just wouldn't start mailing stuff to them. You get it.
Elijah made you something similar. He went out, I guess, and told his friends, and they got pretty successful. He said, do you want to join my list?
Ask for permission.
Yeah, and
it'll be a better list.
I would like to add that giving somebody a business card doesn't give you permission.
That's too bad, man. You're all on my list. Is that it?
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to learn more about conversion and how to improve conversion rates on your site, visit The Conversion Scientist, www.conversionscientist.com.